Hi everyone, it's Dr. Denise. I'm so excited. During this time of being in quarantine, I'm finding that I get to connect with so many cool people. I don't know if you're finding that too. And I was so fortunate. I went to my LinkedIn inbox and I got this amazing message from Dr. Austin Harris. And he's a board certified cardiothoracic anesthesiologist. And it was the coolest, like, hello and shout out. And I just want to say thank you, Austin, for saying hi to me and for us having such a great conversation last week.
It is my pleasure, Denise. And I'm really excited that we could keep getting to know each other.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's one of the interesting things about human beings. We're really adapting. I'm finding that I'm using my time while we're at stay at home to not only do some FaceTime, fortunately, to see my patients FaceTime, but to connect with visionaries. And I've got athletes that I'm doing work with. And what I love about Dr. Harris is that he and I are both so passionate about treating and seeing the whole person. And we both practice an integrative medicine and a wellness, not illness approach.
Absolutely. I think that's really the only way to go about it. Each individual deserves a customized approach on how to improve their wellness and their overall enjoyment of life. That's what they deserve.
Yeah, absolutely. And then what I want to say to that too is, you know, I think it's really interesting. You know, sometimes, you know, people say, you know, you're done, you've got all your certifications, and we'll go through that. But I think people like to know sort of what inspires us, right? So what inspired you on your path to becoming a physician?
Well, that actually took place very young. I think at first one point I was going to be a fighter jet pilot, and that immediately transitioned into doctor, and it just stuck. This was in like elementary school. I thought it would be the perfect combination of purpose and science and service and the ability to put that into a career that I could then look back on and be proud of. It just seemed like a natural fit.
That's great. And do you have some, like, was there any aha moments or family members or people that really kind of helped you to have clarity on this too along the way?
Well, both my parents are PhD psychologists, so they did have the academic background to sort of know how to guide me a bit and how to bring up ideas such that, you know, I would catch them on my own. And I think that, you know, was really helpful to have that sort of guidance.
Oh, that's excellent. And so what I really loved about our talk last week is I'm always looking for wellness and not illness strategies, good healthy nutrition, fitness, cognitive behavioral therapy, mindfulness training. But now we know that there are new and exciting treatments for depression, anxiety, pain, and addiction. And I so appreciate our time last week because wisdom and clinical experience and hearing your experience as a cardiothoracic anesthesiologist for over a decade, you've had some interesting aha moments with the use of ketamine prior to forming your clinic. And I'd love to just hear about that journey.
Absolutely. So after my training in anesthesiology, I did a fellowship at USC in cardiothoracic anesthesiology, which is the use of anesthesiology in major and traumatic surgery, such as open heart surgery, open lung surgery, heart and lung transplantation, major trauma, major vascular, major spine surgery. And so we did learn some additional techniques that really is not focused on too much in the general anesthesiology residency. One of those techniques was using ketamine, which really is not a mainstay of general anesthetic principles. It's something we've had. We have it in the tool shed. We've had it since 1962 when it was invented by the military to treat field trauma. And it's maintained in the medical culture, but it was rarely used. However, with that extra training, we did find certain situations where it was a method of choice. So that's where I first learned how to administer it. And then what I was realizing as I was going through my private practice later on was that there was a lot of situations where I actually found that I could be using ketamine in non-open heart cases, for example. And the positive after effects that I started to witness in the patients on a one-by-one basis was just really shocking. So take example, you had, let's say, a 55-year-old woman with a history of chronic back pain, multiple surgeries, still disabled, in a lot of pain, understandably depressed and anxious, on, several pain medications of different kinds. And let's say she just fell down and twisted her knee. So she would come in for a knee arthroscopy surgery. And instead of sort of going about things, which I think 99.5% of other anesthesiologists would do, I would actually integrate ketamine into that anesthetic protocol. And the after effects as people are recovering from the surgery were just really startling. So in this theoretical person, you would then see them wake up much more smoothly from anesthesia, no nausea, no after pain in her knee, and surprisingly, no pain in her back for the first time in 20 years.
Wow.
Depression and anxiety would be lifted. And probably most surprisingly, these individuals were not asking for pain medication after surgery, which was really surprising, because anyone who's dependent on these medications on a daily basis, they need them quite badly, especially after, additional surgery or things like that. But they weren't asking for it for days, which is just mind-blowing.
So I want to say something that's super important. And I just want to, I really connected with you last week, because what I love is, we go to medical school, we have our training, but we're also, as scientists and as clinicians, we also are always constantly doing the scientific method. And I just want to go through this for everyone. The scientific method is make an observation, ask a question, form a hypothesis or testable explanation, make a prediction based on the hypothesis, test the prediction, iterate, use the results to make new hypotheses or predictions. And I want to let everyone know that as I got to know Dr. Harris on the phone, I was just so grateful and excited, because he had years of experience with this particular ketamine. And then he had these observations. And over time, he fine-tuned it based on the scientific method. And then he's been gathering data, seeing clinical outcomes. And I just want to thank you, Dr. Harris, for all your integration of your knowledge.
It's my pleasure. Really, the biggest the benefit is watching these patients, now clients, get such remarkable, just transformative results from the therapies that we've now perfected, and how it happens so quickly over the course of maybe just an hour or two. It's just so gratifying to watch and be a part of that process.
Oh, no, absolutely. And so let's go there. Let's go there, because as everyone knows, I'm an adult and child psychiatrist. I have, 40,000 hours of treating depression, anxiety, addiction. And I'm kind of known as the doctor in town that uses the least amount of medicines. And I really empower people. And I love having new tools in the toolbox. And definitely. So depending on, I think a lot of times as doctors, we almost can get a little bit concerned. Like for me personally, if a new treatment comes out, I like to wait a while, get the data, see what's happening, then talk to someone like yourself who has another MD background like myself. And so you have different superpowers as a doctor, and I have different superpowers. So let's talk about the way you, before we talk about the mechanism of action of ketamine and how it works, let's talk about how you integrate and reach out with other professionals to help patients and to help identify people who are having treatment-resistant anxiety or depression or addiction and or different pain syndromes.
So basically, over the years of private practice, I always took, as you describe it, this more integrative approach, where a really healthy respect for all different fields of medicine and other practitioners out there that are involved in the health and wellness space. I maintain those relationships, and it's incredibly useful and gratifying to be able to and then integrate their skills or superpowers with what I can offer to an individual. So if a patient comes in with X, Y, or Z, they get an independent evaluation based on experience and objective assessments. And then using that information, we try to form a completely customized, tailor-made care plan for that individual. And that may include some of the services that we can provide at our clinic. And usually it also includes integrating that with other health professionals that can bring their superpowers to bear. And it's different for each patient. So in one patient, I may say, you know, I think I need this patient to also talk to Dr. Denise, or I may need them to see an additional pain management specialist or a physical therapist or an addiction counselor, and bring all the different forces to bear that in that particular individual would be beneficial to them long term. That's what integrated medicine is all about.
Yes, and I was really fortunate, and I sent you right before we did this interview, I sent you the slides to my PowerPoint. I was really fortunate. I was asked by the Tibetan Medical Society in 2018 to go and talk about nurturing children's mental health from a Western medicine perspective, but I'm really an integrative doctor. And so I talked about the biological, the psychological, the social, and the cultural. And I think when we look at things, I love when I read your bio, and it's going to be in the blog post on my site. I like what you said about one plus one size fits one, because that's in absolute synergy with my feeling of the word that I like to use. It's a non-stigma word when talking about mental health. I have this term, there's in the academic world, we talk about neurotypical and we talk about neurodiversity. And we have different terms that are very academic, right? And I think the world really likes to think of themselves in a much more colorful way than a diagnosis. So I thought I came up with this word neurostyle, which is that we all process and perceive information in our own unique way. And when I say that word, that is all encompassing. That includes biological, psychological, social, and cultural. And also, you know, that includes people's gender, identity, their sexuality. And then people have a way of talking about something that really gives them permission where they're not necessarily always using the word disorder. And so my big superpower working with my patients is taking the shame away, taking the stigma away, and really getting someone to be their own best healer.
Absolutely.
And then giving them the data.
Definitely. You want people to feel included and empowered in their own care plan and their own self-improvement. And I think it's a magnificent terminology that encompasses everything that we're trying to say.
Right. And you know what? I think a lot of people, by the time they come to you, because, and I think I want to have this really interesting discussion with you, because I know you focus on wellness versus illness. And I think a lot of times, depending on the time you trained in medicine, it was more of a reactive instead of a proactive mm-hmm. approach. And the pendulum's swinging now. Everything's about anti-inflammation. I'm really, really, I'd love for you to see the work of Dr. Beth Frates at Harvard. She's a lifestyle medicine pioneer. I think she's going to be one of the people on your team that you're going to vet to work with. And so we're starting to have a different use of language in a different way that we're kind of thinking about things in terms of prevention. So I'd be interested to hear sort of the range of clients that come to see you, those who are treatment-resistant depression or anxiety, people with pain, but then also people that might be like, I don't necessarily want to go on any Western medicine. Might I try ketamine first? I guess you've probably seen it all.
Yeah, we do see a really wide range of presentations. And, you know, again, trying to view each person as unique, we probably tease out more of those individual facets of someone's needs by going about it that approach. So someone may come in with a very obvious presentation, like they've had multiple back surgeries, they still have neuropathic pain, and ketamine is excellent at modulating that and thereby decreasing their necessity on specifically opiate pain medications, or we may have someone who has just really suffered due to treatment-resistant major depressive disorder. They may have been through so many different medications, so many different therapists, so many different procedures, even including ECT, electroconvulsive therapy. I mean, folks that are really resistant and really need help, and we can bring all the tools to bear that's necessary. The goal is to hopefully reduce the number of tools that are necessary. And that's what makes me so excited about this new field is it does simplify things a lot. So you have the really difficult presentations, but we try to make them easier. And then you have people that are just suffering from daily mood fluctuations that sort of are a little bit more pendulum, as you will, from probably what they could achieve, without those variations. And the ketamine therapy actually works on them too very well to help modulate and help the brain to adapt to healthier perspectives and thought processes. The same with, it comes with addiction. You know, you have people that, through no fault of their own, have out of necessity needed to take a lot of medications, specifically pain medications or other forms of treatment. And our body reacts to that by becoming dependent upon them. And again, that's just a natural process and there's no stigma there. And our goal then is to help the nervous system to reset and develop alternative mechanisms towards dealing with their physiologic concerns that doesn't involve such massive doses. So we can reset those receptors back to square one almost and really improve a patient's quality of life on a daily basis. And that would extend to a lot of the more illicit substances as well. I mean, at this point, we can basically get someone into a recovery pathway and stop their withdrawal in 20 minutes, which is a real eye-opener.
Oh, no, this is everything you're discussing is game-changer thought processes. And I too have always liked to have my patients the least amount of appointments. I work with kids, teens, and adults. We want them out thriving, not in our offices. And I think that this adjunctive tool of ketamine is going to really shift things, especially when people become more educated. I think a lot of times doctors, when it's something new, and also depending on the time of their training, if they don't have the clinical experience that you have, they might be like, oh my goodness, they might be afraid to do the referral. And what I'd love for you to explain to people, which you did so eloquently on our call last week, is just explain the let's look at major depression or anxiety, and let's look at the glutamate story. Tell us the story that everyone can understand about what happens when they go and they come in to see you and they're being assessed for depression or anxiety, and how you explain what's going to happen from a neurophysiological standpoint.
Of course. So there are three major changes that we're looking to see take place in a person with, let's say, depression. So what happens in depression is there's a neurotransmitter imbalance. And what that basically means is as these impulses are traveling down thousands of neurons trying to get from A to B, they will cross synapses that need to be optimized. And so to do that, that information travels from transmitters being released from one end of the synapse to receptors that receive them on the other end of the synapse and then pass along and propagate that signal. If there's any discrepancy in that relationship, that's where we start seeing a real breakdown of process and functionality. So in terms of modern psychiatry, we've always been focused as medicine in terms of trying to optimize the amount of transmitter or the signal, for example, serotonin or dopamine or norepinephrine. That's the majority of all medications that are geared towards treating depression. And what we actually discovered by reverse engineering the ketamine response was we were only seeing one half of the equation. Mm-hmm. The other side of that is the receptors. So at some point, if you're really increasing serotonin, like with Zoloft or something like that, that if there's not enough receptors to receive that concentration of serotonin, then it doesn't make any difference. The analogy I like to use is if you have an office building and you have 200 employees, but you only have 10 employee parking spaces, how many people do you think are really coming to work that day? And what do you think the overall functionality will be of that office? Very low. So what we found is that ketamine serves as an on switch for a very important enzyme, and it's called brain-derived neurotrophic factor. This is a naturally occurring enzyme that we find is in much lower concentrations in certain areas of the brain in certain people that are suffering from, let's say, depression. Ketamine turns an on switch for the expression and increased concentration of this BDNF molecule. This molecule then goes and does three major functions. One, it goes and it monitors and adjusts the relationship at synapses. So if there's not enough transmitter, it'll increase that. If there's not enough receptors or badly functioning ones, as in the case with a lot of mental health challenges, it will then signal the increase in production of those receptors. So now you have more functionality. The second big thing that it does is it actually works on the nerve cell structures and pathways themselves. There's a phenomenon called neuroplasticity. And basically what that means is that our brains are very adaptive and they just need the fuel to be able to do that work. So for example, if there's an area of trauma, whether it's physical or emotional, it all boils down to being an anatomic glitch in that area. And sometimes that can be fixed by increasing work to do that fixing. And sometimes it just needs to work around or make a detour. So what brain-derived neurotrophic factor does is it provides the signal to do that work. And you can actually resolve the congestion, let's say on a freeway that way, by building an alternative lane and thereby increasing functionality. And this works not just for depression, but also for pain signals and for addiction. And the third major way that this works is a lot of times the medications that we take, let's say for depression. Now, what we found is that a lot of people that are suffering from depression actually are suffering from a loss of receptor numbers at that synapse. And that can't be fixed by giving more Zoloft. So what the BDNF does is it increases the number of those synapses, but it also encourages the development of a healthy balance, such as how much overall on or off that synapse is going to have. Sometimes there are these side synapses. They come in and they like to modulate what's happening, let's say, at a glutamate synapse. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, those can serve to be an atrophic signal. In other words, it sort of weakens the ability, which is good in short term with anxiety, but long term, not so good. It creates an atrophy of that situation by turning off that off system, which is an NMDA receptor on that interneuron per se. With the off, now you have a default on position. And now all this restructuring and rebuilding of the intrinsic architecture of that little situation can get back to maximum functionality, and the results are fantastic.
You know what? As you're discussing this, number one, I'm thinking I would love for you to also write an adjunctive blog post for me with your bio that's breaking down, like, we've got ketamine, then reset, then these are these three things, and we'll do it in such a way that people can really get it. But then as I'm listening to you, I'm imagining like a super highway, mm-hmm. and like 405, and then different stop signs. But then at the stop sign, I'm actually looking at like almost like a teeter totter, because things are either going to go, the green light's going to go on, it's going to be yellow, or it's going to be red, green, or yellow. But you've got the substrate, which is the actual chemical or the neurochemical, which I picture like a teeter totter, where it's like too much or too little.
Right.
So you've got substrate, and then you've got functionality, then you've got things that need to transport.
And in people with depression, a lot of these four-way stop signs or four-way traffic signals are broken. In other words, instead of being green or red, they're just in that flashing red, and everyone's mm-hmm. trying to figure out who goes next. And that really is what, you know, breaks down overall speed and functionality.
Fantastic. Fantastic. And I think that when people start to realize that, they also feel incredibly validated, especially the people that have gone through and had multiple medication trials. And besides the functionality and what you're discussing, there's also the pharmacogenetics that we all in our livers have, you know, our cytochrome P450, we have different ways that we metabolize meds. So we are very complex creatures, right? And so we have to, this is why it's so important, everyone. And I'd love for Dr. Harris to talk about this. Well, maybe we'll get to that in a minute. What I want to say as a doctor, it's incredibly important if you're suffering with depression, anxiety, ADHD, pain, addiction, that you go and get a proper consult. Because a lot of times people might just only see one perspective, and it's a real integrative solution. That's and a lot of times people just do one thing, and then maybe they're missing the boat on optimal health.
100%.
So do you want to finish the, so the mechanism of action. So can you talk about the mechanism of action for, did you feel like you've covered it for depression? I want to make sure we finish that thought before we go on to pain.
Yeah, I think that pretty much covers it. The bottom line is, you know, looking at it in a big view, is a lot of people that have been resistant to being able to improve functionality, that it's not their fault. There are anatomic issues with the actual architecture of certain synapses that have to be fixed in order for functionality to come back. And when you combine that with other forms of well-being, such as therapy and, you know, possibly minimizing or just making sure you're on the right medications, a lot of times we see this real rebound in function, and even in terms of people maybe not needing medications, because once the architecture is fixed and the balance has been restored molecularly, that the brain will take care of what it needs to do. It's just sometimes it gets in its own way. And what ketamine does is it makes all the traffic signals work again. It redirects traffic. It builds detours. And bottom line is just to get us back to being our best selves.
That's fantastic. Can you talk about how the mechanism is a little bit different with regard to pain?
Of course. So our nervous systems are comprised of two different families. There's the central nervous system, which is the brain and the spinal cord. And then there's the peripheral nervous system, which is everything else. And they're constantly balancing against each other. So whatever is on in the central nervous system or the brain is off, let's say, in your foot. The same signals work in opposite. And that's a safety guard that our evolution has put in place for us so we don't get overwhelming stimuli. But basically in pain, everything that I was discussing is inverted. So without appropriate concentrations of brain-derived neurotrophic factor, what you see is pain stimuli and our body's response to that becoming dysregulated. And it happens this way. Let's say I stub my toe, you know, it hurts for a few minutes and then it goes away. But if there's a trauma, like I drop a anvil on my toe and it gets really crushed, the toe may eventually regenerate, but there are nerve fibers that are in that may not recover so quickly and sometimes at all. And they're still firing out this sort of acute pain signal, even though the stimulus is gone. Those pain signals evolutionarily are supposed to be of the utmost priority in our nervous system. So if there's ongoing pain, your interpretation of that is my foot is still in the lion's mouth, or I'm still in a burning building, and whatever action I need to take as a result of this stimulus is life altering and saving. So it's frantically trying to get attention. And when it doesn't feel it's getting addressed, it actually starts to ramp up its volume. And it does that in a couple different mechanisms. One is it actually adds receptors at these synapses, which creates excessive strength of the pain signal that's getting expressed. Another thing is
opposite of what we just discussed with mood and anxiety.
Absolutely.
Okay, there's not enough. If there's a parking lot, Dr. Austin explained to me. So essentially, there's not enough spaces in the parking lot for scenario one with mood and anxiety.
Exactly.
Scenario two, there's too many parking spots.
Exactly. Now you've got everybody parking from the whole community in your parking space, and you know nobody can figure out where they're going, and so everybody's yelling. And so that's
basically sounds like the pandemic.
Totally.
is the pandemic. Okay, keep going.
So what the BDNF will do once it's been properly expressed with being turned on by ketamine is we'll then take away some of those excessive receptors. And so this central sensitization process, which is what it's called technically, which ramps up the volume and speed of these stimuli that results in chronic pain, gets reversed by removing receptors. It works on ion-gated calcium channels to actually revert them back structurally to their naive setup so that the firing rates of those signals goes back down to normal. And then there's also the interpretive side of it in the spinal cord, where these long neurons, let's say from my toe to my brain, people think there's probably thousands of neurons. There's actually only two. There's one very, very long neuron that goes from my toe all the way up into the dorsal horn of my spinal cord, and then one more that connects up to my brain. So any interruption in signal during that entire length, which is really long, can result in just sort of a catastrophic scenario. By actually healing some of the nerve tissue, which is another thing the BDNF does, resetting the receptor relationships, lowering the firing rates, you can get chronic neuropathic or other structural pain. There's about 20 different sympathetically mediated pain syndromes in our body that we now know without a shadow of doubt that ketamine is extremely beneficial in modulating. This allows people to improve functionality, decrease the number of pain medicines that they're having to take, do better physical therapy and get themselves stronger, and just really put them on the right path to living a better life.
So how does the scenario look for addiction?
Addiction is both central and peripheral.
Okay.
So with addiction, you have this maladaptive setup. So let's say someone takes an opiate like OxyContin or something like that, right? Whether it's legal or illegal. And they get this sort of euphoria from it. And if they did have any pain, they're not getting the pain anymore. And they think, well, this is great. This is the solution to all my problems. But then the flip side comes, and that is that the receptors that identify the OxyContin change. They actually start to lower their set point. So if you look at sort of a line graph, you have sort of a median point at which there's no pain, right? And if the set point lowers, that means your pain threshold lowers. In other words, it's easier for you to have pain. And that's what happens with opiates, is in addition to many other physiologic dysregulation that occurs, it actually makes your stimulus for having pain lower. In other words, when you don't have it, you get pain easier and more. And this creates a dependency. And that's the peripheral dependency. Then there's the central dependency in terms of real dysregulation of our neural synapses and our reward systems, which are very complicated synergy between different aspects of our brain. It affects our mood centers. It affects our prefrontal cortex or our emotional memory. It affects the locus coeruleus, which is sort of our activation center in the brainstem. And these areas become basically dependent. In other words, if they don't have that, now they feel as if they're abnormal. And that's when people get into real trouble. And especially with other medications or drugs, including other opioids like heroin or methamphetamine, alcohol, benzodiazepines, cocaine, all of these create a dysregulation in terms of our body's perception of our normal environment. And then it goes to the opposite when it's not there, hence the craving, the addiction, and the dependency. What ketamine does is it goes back in and it just says, whoa, hold the phone. I don't know what's going on here, but this is all wrong. And by increasing that BDNF, now you have the workforce to be able to go back in there, reset these receptors structurally back to their original naive setup. And what that does is basically put people back on the road, and it reduces the craving, which reduces the use, which reduces the dependency. And it really gives people an entirely new lease on life.
Now, this is fantastic. So I'm starting to think about how this could, with all the data that you've been collecting and educating not only doctors, therapists, but also the general public, it'd be so incredible if we could have more of a universal screening and who could benefit from this, and also a way that we could get the insurance companies to cover more of these treatments. Absolutely. Because in the long run, it's going to save money, it's going to save time, people are going to have optimal health, they're going to be on less medications, there's going to be less need for rehab clinics, less relapses, because it seems like, you know, as we're fortunate to evolve as scientists and doctors, we're living in a time where we now have more of an understanding, and it's just constantly happening. And I think what happens in any system, you get this new information or these new ideas, and oftentimes it takes the world like maybe 10 to 15 years to really get it. What are your thoughts on that?
And one of my major missions and others in my field is to think about this pragmatically. A lot of these folks that are clients of ours and patients of others, they go through a lot of different treatments, and all of this is costly.
Yes.
Sometimes it's costly to the individual. Sometimes it's costly to the insurance company. And the end result is it's really a massive bill.
Well, and it's more than fiscal. It's the loss of income, the loss of functionality, divorce, problems. It's a big ripple effect. And we both have that data. You have that data on your site, but it's like unimaginable how much this could be a game changer if we had a way to integrate this consultation. In fact, when I first was speaking with you in the first 2 minutes, I kind of listened to my higher self. I do a lot of meditation. And the first thing I kept getting is a ketamine consult, like coming up with like a universal way that maybe you and I and some other people that you vetted over time as we know one another can come up with a way to really educate people. And I think even you and I doing this interview today is a start, right? 100%. Because the more we have knowledge and power, and I love your site, which we're going to talk about, you know, we need the wisdom, we need the scientific method, we need the experience, and then we need to have protocol. But we need to make it cost effective, because right now what happens is a lot of these treatments aren't as covered by insurance. And so that's where you get sort of people that just are maybe stuck on meds they don't need to be on. And I, by the way, everyone, I'm not against Western medicine. I want to make it really clear. I'm an MD. I do prescribe meds, but I always try to do the least amount of meds. So I think where Dr. Harris and I are in alignment is, let's look at the whole person, and let's look at the most cost-effective way for people to thrive and be out of our offices.
Absolutely. And focus on regaining function instead of just reflexively prescribing, because we feel that's all we have in our arsenal. By having this additional tool, and when you combine that synergistically with a small number of other fields and bringing those superpowers together, the goal is not to have someone be a client or a patient forever. I mean, that is a real old think way about going at medicine. The goal is to have happy clients, happy patients, get back on their feet and not need us anymore. And that success will bring in new clients and new patients that are looking for the same results. So we need to focus on regaining wellness and health instead of just treating an illness, you know, in perpetuity.
No, absolutely. And I think we've got a new wave of thinkers. And I think that the more we also educate some of our colleagues of all different ages to be flexible, you know, whether they're younger or older than us, I think it's super important to keep an open mind. And how do you think that if you were kind of, how do you think psychiatrists and therapists can best identify clients that could benefit from this? I mean, I have my ideas, but I'd love to know your clinical experience already, because I'm starting to formulate my thoughts of how to refer to you and how we can work together. But I'd love to see like what your experience has been already.
My experience is that the earlier that you can treat something, the easier it is to reverse. And unfortunately, in medicine, what we tend to do when we find a new protocol or a new medication or a new therapy is we start treating the folks that are really in the most dire situations because it seems safe to start in that situation because nothing else is working. So we might as well try X, Y, or Z. I really think we need to get away from that. I think the model has been proven. And, you know, instead of just focusing on the really treatment resistant individuals, you know, we need to help people not to get so off the rails in the beginning. And the sooner that we can do that, the sooner we detour back onto a healthier pathway. Now, I'm not saying that ketamine therapy should be a first line medication. I don't think we have evidence to support that yet. But I think it definitely could be a second or third line in terms of, okay, if you're already engaged in a good psychologist or a good psychiatrist where, you know, you're getting all of the good cognitive behavioral training and you're getting what would be, you know, good starting medications to treat the specifically diagnosed issue, but that even that is not working, I think that's when we should transition more into not staying on a treatment pathway for so long if we don't see that it's benefiting.
No, and, I 1000% agree with you.
You know, just move on to the next thing. And that doesn't mean adding things. It doesn't mean like if you fail one medication, add two more.
Yes.
Unfortunately, that's what we do too much.
Yeah, I'd love to talk about that because I feel very fortunate because I have my own practice and I spend a lot of time with my patients and I really like to use the scientific method and make oftentimes like one change per month. And I love doing takeaways mm-hmm. instead of add-ons. And I love to educate with my patients, even if you're able to add on, like I really call my patients out. I'm like, wait a second, you're not doing the recommended cardio. You're not doing the recommended strength training. And I really have people, I talk about exercise as mind medicine, nutrition as mind medicine. Absolutely. And I educate them with the importance of sleep. And that's, you know, all throughout my site. But then I think the other part is some people, and I know you've seen this, I think the most challenging referral would be someone who's almost been living with depression or they've had abuse as a child mm-hmm. and their neuro style is such that maybe they didn't get cognitive behavioral or dialectical behavioral therapy and they don't even realize it. They don't even realize that they're actually kind of married to their disease, so to speak. Exactly. And so I have a way to, maybe you can talk about that. I mean, I have deep compassion because if someone maybe was abused as a child, they already were genetically predisposed to depression or anxiety, and then now relationship after relationship doesn't work, they haven't had enough inspiration or hope or the right treatment to come in to getting the highest level of success for some of these alternative treatments because their mindset needs to go into it with a full healing approach. And I think we need to really have a screening process for that. What are your thoughts on that?
And I agree. I think that one, It's education, education, education. In other words, getting these ideas and these treatment models in front of people who need them. You know, it's been an uphill process, you know, because there is a lot of resistance in medicine and in pharmacology and in these industries to, you know, not really want to simplify it, not really want to make it easier for patients, unfortunately. And I think that if people that want to honestly want to see improvement in their lives, obviously that's very important. But once they have just that, that's all it takes. Then all they need to know is that there's an alternative. They need to see it. They need to read about it. And that falls on us to really do our best jobs at bringing these resources, giving this option to society at large, so that this is right up there with other strategies like, you know, medications or, you know, just talk therapy, but that this integrative model of treating mental health, pain, addiction, that this is something that we can put on a stand at equal standing with these other models of caring for patients. So that I think that makes it a much easier choice for people when they know that there is this, you know, more integrative way at self-improvement.
Perfect.
And they see that model versus, oh, well, somebody's just going to prescribe me 10 medications and I sit on my couch. I think that makes the choice a lot easier.
Oh, gosh. You know, actually, this is going to sound funny. You don't know this about me. I actually have people call me and they go, but you will prescribe if I need it, right?
We've been trained.
No, but it's funny. I have the reputation of not pulling the prescription pad out right away.
Mm-hmm.
And people know that I'm going to just, you know, kind of challenge them, look at all the ways for wellness. And it's really funny. I'm like, yeah, of course. If I think it's indicated, I will write a prescription. I have, you know, I work with, of course, I'm a bone and child psychiatrist. I know how to treat ADD and I'm not against meds. Meds serve their purpose.
The right tool for the right job.
Everything. So can you give us, I want two really important things before we finish up this really amazing interview and just sharing your time and wisdom. Yeah. Number one, can you give us one of your, without maybe change the demographics, but maybe one of your biggest wins that you've seen with treatment-resistant depression. And then the second thing would be maybe talk about what people would expect if they're coming in to see you, whether it's for the mood and anxiety protocol versus the pain protocol.
Of course. You'll actually see this interview since we have all the HIPAA-appropriate releases and everything. I can discuss it. We had this individual that came into our clinic and a really wonderful gentleman who was suffering from a combination of chronic pain and depression, which is very, very common, actually.
Yes,
one,
I see that
one
a lot.
Gets the other and back and forth, and it's a sort of linked spiral that occurs. And, you know, he had had major physical trauma that had caused him to be disabled. And, you know, he just lost the ability to find enjoyment in life because of the disability. And then at some point, the depression takes a life of its own. And now, even if you've figured out how to be more functional physically, the depression still lingers because you feel like you've missed out. And you combine that with childhood traumas, like people that we've lost and things like that, but are unresolved. And what you get is a really difficult picture. So in someone like this, what the ketamine does is works in multiple directions. It actually works on about 5 or 6 different receptors at once. And that's a very rare in any modern medication. Usually it's like sort of one receptor, one action sort of model. But because this has been around for, you know, 70 years, 60 years, you know, this has already been approved. And what that does is you can treat more than one thing at a time. We can walk and chew gum. So in this individual, in addition to helping decrease his daily pain, we treated the organic aspects of depression, combined with a therapist that he was seeing that I would work integratively with. And you add into that that ketamine opens doors. So in life, our most obvious and most used defense mechanism is, I don't want to deal with this, put it in the closet. And eventually those closets just fill up and then it starts to spill out into your bedroom. And at that point, you don't have any mechanisms left. And that's when crisis happens. What ketamine does is it puts you in that room, but removes all fear, all anxiety, and just objectively sort of lets you stand above that situation and go, huh, well, this isn't right. What can I do about this? And the brain starts to do its own repairs. It starts to clean up the closets, throw away, confront, and then discard whatever is unnecessary today, reorganize, put back what's still necessary to keep, close the door, take a deep breath, and realize that, you know, you feel cleansed, you feel unburdened. He was able to resolve issues with relatives that had passed. He was a very well-adjusted man. And, you know, during the session, you know, he actually started to weep quite powerfully. And that's a good thing.
Oh, yeah. Tears, actually, everyone, are super healing. They even show that there's salt on the tears. So it sounded like
that we're actually processing what we've been holding on to. And once it's been processed, we can organize and or discard it and get real lightness back into our life.
Yes.
He stood up after his first treatment. He walked over to me and just hugged me.
Oh.
And just thanked me and just said, that was the most amazing thing I've ever done. I don't even know how to talk about it right now, but I'll call you. And I really want to talk about this.
Wow. How long ago was this with this person?
A couple months ago.
Wow. Maybe I know that this is like out of the box. That's how I like to think, but I always like to respect. I have someone in my practice, like, I heard your show. I want to go on and I want to tell them all about it. I'm like, oh gosh, HIPAA, right? But if this person already signed this, maybe they'll want to be interviewed on the show.
You'll actually be able to see the interview on our website.
Oh, perfect. Okay, maybe then we'll link that. We're going to link it all. You and I will talk about how to make it very easy for people to access in a blog post that you can write. We'll figure it all out. It's going to be great. Excellent. And so how many treatments? I know you explained this to me last week. I know that I want to be very clear that Dr. Harris does one size fits one, meaning everything we just talked about with the therapist, the nutrition, the consult, who's appropriate. And then there's usually X amount of sessions if there's mental health and also pain.
Right.
But he also doses it per situation based on clinical experience and scientific method.
Yeah. You know, unfortunately, there's a lot of practitioners out there that sort of use the same, you know, this number of milligrams per kilogram for everybody. And that really does not get optimal results. And what we do is, based on these objective assessments and speaking with their psychiatrists, understanding their physiologies, their metabolisms, their height, age, weight, ethnicity, other things that they've tried in the past, how they respond to, you know, certain physiologic challenges, all this goes into an algorithm that I use to customize a specific protocol for that individual. And then each session, and during the stabilization period, which is 6 sessions in 3 weeks, we actually increase the dosing as much as we can while maintaining that same pleasant experience, because the data is very clear that the more we can increase the dosing, the more beneficial effects that we get, both short and long term. So all that takes a real watchful eye. We actually, based on some of the machinery that we have, we can alter dosing and infusion rates up and down with even in the same session, and really just dial in the sweet spot for getting people the perfect therapeutic level of the medication and where they're at physiologically, that I know from experience is going to get them the most results. So we do that.
And you also, on your site, so it looks like there's usually an 80% success rate.
Mm-hmm.
And then
I would say it's probably higher, but you know, we do run into individuals that are just super resistant. A lot of them usually were referred by somebody else who thought they would be helped by this, but I don't think they themselves are really ready to walk through those doors. Like, I like to say that ketamine opens doors, but it is up to the individual. And this is where therapy and psychiatry can really help, is to then walk through those doors. That takes an act of will. And
yes, people have to do the work. They have to 100%. Have that pre-contemplation phase that they show that works the best in addiction, when someone's really ready to make the decision to be healthy and I want to be well.
Absolutely.
Because some people, for whatever reason, and this is beyond just the substrate and the neurofunction, on a deeper human spirit level, they haven't looked and said, I deserve to be happy. I want to be well. And that's where the right therapist, psychiatrist,
absolutely,
can be the big game changer. And also sometimes it's just another person. Like if someone goes to your site and watches that interview and sees like, oh my goodness, they have what I had and I can have hope. I think hope is a big part of this too, as far as getting better. Hello?
Yes.
Okay, good.
It's huge. That decision and helping someone to get into the frame of mind of wanting to get better is probably the most important step in any recovery process.
Well, great. So is there anything, any other points we wanted to make before we hear about how people can find you? And, you know, really, really, I just thank you so much for today.
No, thank you so much, Denise. Bottom line, I just wanted to leave an overview, and that is that when you do go through these experiences, it is extremely personalized. Everyone has their own private treatment room. They all candlelit. They have, noise canceling Bluetooth headphones with meditation music, little sleep eye masks. They recline in electronic reclining chairs. It's just an incredibly peaceful meditative environment. We do not get any reports of any negative experiences. They've all been positive in terms of the experience itself. And, the success rate and the speed at which people start seeing positive changes, it's just really remarkable. And it's definitely something I recommend for the right individuals.
That's great. And I really appreciate the time you and I spent together last week looking at ways that we can work together to educate people, inspire people, and figure out different protocols that make the most sense to get the word out and also use the scientific method. So thank you for that time and time today.
Of course, Denise, anytime.
And then also just let us know how people can find you. I'll put the link on my site, but can you give us your website information?
Absolutely. So you can go to www.neuroreliefketamine.com. That's NEURORELIEFKETAMINE.com. And from there, there's also links to our social media, which includes Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, and Twitter.
Great. Well, thank you so much. It's so exciting to hear another tool in the toolbox to focus on wellness and not illness. And thank you. And thanks everyone for listening. And we'll be back soon.
Have a great day.